We're going to call our House Committee on Rules to order, and with that, what do you want me to do with that first one?
You might just have me announce it.
Yeah, we'll have you announce we're going to get a resolution proposed and get it sent off so that we can get the proposal.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. We have a proposal for a request for a resolution for a measure that will honor former speakers of the House. And so we have a formal proposed motion that will accomplish that.
Yeah. Okay, so let the record show that we do have a quorum present, which is nice. And we have at times we have difficulty getting everybody here at the same time because we have so many things going on, and I was kind of surprised to see everybody here. We have other people who will be leaving us at different times during the day, so it's an exciting afternoon.
Looks like he's disappointed that some of us showed up.
You might ask him.
He's going to vote some of us off the island.
You can't find it anymore. Can I make this motion?
Sure. Mr. Chair?
Yep.
I move, in compliance with House rules, that the Speaker be requested to approve a drafting request for a measure that will honor former speakers of the Oregon House of Representatives.
Okay. Representative Edwards moves that. The House that moves that, in compliance with House rules, that the Speaker be requested to approve a drafting request for a measure that will honor former speakers of the Oregon House of Representatives. Discussion. We have a short. Do you want to read?
I'm happy to read it. I think I handed it.
Okay, with that one. Okay.
The proposed language is: whereas former speakers of the Oregon House of Representatives continually answered the call to public service, and whereas those former speakers have dutifully worked on behalf of their constituents, and whereas these former speakers have honorably served the Oregon Legislative Assembly, and whereas these former speakers have worked tirelessly on behalf of the people of Oregon in good times and bad, and whereas these former speakers have authorized key legislation that has made significant improvements for the state of Oregon, and whereas these former speakers have provided Oregon with leadership and vision to allow Oregon to develop the reputation of being forward-thinking, and whereas these former speakers have continued their faithful service to Oregon even after completing their tenure as a speaker, now therefore be it resolved by the House of Representatives of the State of Oregon that we, the members of the House of Representatives of the 75th Legislative Assembly, extend our gratitude to the former speakers of the Oregon House of Representatives for the years of service, many achievements, and continued contributions to the betterment of the State of Oregon.
Okay. So that's the resolution, and we had a request to put this in just so they could get it drafted and then to decide. So it's kind of like a committee bill. But what we're doing is asking that a letter be sent to the Speaker to allow that to be done. Any discussion? Representative Berger.
I feel like I'm not getting the whole picture here, Mr. Chair. I don't know. If you have more information, I certainly wouldn't object to this.
I don't have a lot of other information.
Suspension of the rules, but I'm just not sure in the middle of a huge economic crisis why we are exactly spending our time on this. Not to offend any former speakers of the House,
okay.
Mind you.
I don't have a lot more information other than it was a request.
I
have those discussions. I leave it to this group to decide what we want to do with that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I feel much the same way as Representative Berger, but in the interest of not spending any more time than we possibly have to on this issue, I will support whatever
Good point.
We want to do as far as drafting this.
And then we can figure out what we want to do with after that. So is there any objection to the motion? Any other discussion? Seeing none. Any objection to us sending a letter requesting the drafting? Seeing no objection, so ordered, and we'll get that drafted. And we didn't use any more time, and I'll sign it. Next, in the meeting of time, we are going to open a public hearing, and it's a little out of order, but we have a senator visiting with us, and I wanted to make sure that she had a chance before she had to go off and do some other important work. So we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 330A. We'll have a short description from our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 330A requires a state initiative and referendum voters pamphlet to include procedures for filing a complaint alleging violations of election laws. The procedures for filing a complaint alleging violations of election laws are contained in ORS 260.345. Any elector suspecting violations of election laws or rules may file a written complaint with any filing officer. Upon receipt of a complaint, the Secretary of State's office must examine the complaint immediately to determine if a violation has occurred. In the case of alleged violations involving the Secretary of State's office, the Attorney General shall receive and investigate the complaint.
And with that, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Mr. Watson. Always a pleasure to see you. I felt a little bit like Edith Ann in that chair. I'm sorry I had to move. It's very short. It must be for people who are on the hot seat. I might suggest that your last resolution, you might make it a rolling resolution so you don't offend any future former speakers of the House. Just, you know, just thought it'd be kind of fun. I'm here on a very simple little bill, and that always frightens me when I hear people say that because it's never simple, but really this is very, very simple. I had more lofty goals for Senate Bill 330, but as always in this building, your lofty goals sometimes get ratcheted down to what is realistic and achievable. So really what 330 does is simply require the voters pamphlet to put in the procedures about how to file a complaint. I mean, it's very simple. Should have been in there all along. Voters' pamphlets like a Bible to most folks in Oregon. They read it pretty religiously, and they like what it has to say. They trust it, and I think there should be information in there. Originally, I had wanted to print in there the five largest contributors to a campaign because, quite frankly, I think money has distorted politics in Oregon and in many other states. And as I worked out the details of that, it became clear that what would happen is all the big money donors would just wait until after the filing deadline for the voters pamphlet, and then you would see the big money come in. So you wouldn't fool anyone. I thought the law we passed last session was a bit silly to color code the out-of-state contributions. That wasn't my idea, but it was stuck in with another bill, so I had to vote for it. But, you know, we're trying to find ways to be transparent to the public, and until we get campaign finance reform, we're not really going to see it. So this is my little window into transparency and accountability for the people of the state of Oregon, instead of sending them to the internet to find out how to do things, because there are a lot of people here who in the state who still do not have a computer. We'll print it in the voters pamphlet, and we'll give them the information they need so that their elections can be as clean as possible and that they feel they have a say in how it runs in Oregon. So that's really it. It very much is a very, very simple little bill. Passed the Senate 24-5.
So are there any questions for this witness? Seeing none, I'm probably, since you were the only one that signed up, I'm probably going to close the public hearing. We may have a work session later today.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. I'm going to go listen to the state police now.
So thank you, and we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 330. And with that, we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2920. We'll have a short explanation, and we'll see if...
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 2920 creates a task force on effective and efficient and cost-efficient service provisions, establishes criteria for membership, process for appointing members, and operating procedures for the task force, directs the task force to review opportunities to provide services in the most effective and cost-efficient manner, and to consider use of intergovernmental agreements to achieve cost savings, requires the task force to analyze services in areas of assessment and taxation, elections, human services, public health, and criminal justice, and requires the task force to submit a report, possibly including recommendations for legislation, to the Interim Legislative Committee dealing with revenue by October 1, 2010. Previously, you discussed a number of issues involving the complexity and inefficiency of existing revenue and governmental structures. There is also an amendment to this bill, the proposed House Bill 2920-1 amendments, specify the size and numerical distribution of task force membership and adds state agencies and county commissioners to required membership categories. It mandates the task force to encourage effective fiscal planning for counties managing the phase-out of federal forest safety net payments, provides for the gubernatorial appointment of the chairperson from the membership of the task force, modifies a reporting requirement by adding an obligation to submit an interim report in 2009, requires the task force to establish a technical committee to aid and advise the task force in its function, and prohibits compensation but allows travel and expense reimbursement to members of the technical committee.
Thank you. Members, this is kind of a picks up where the governor's task force last time on county payments went to try to make sure that we keep on track when we know that the county payments are going to end. And we it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
It does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
And this next couple weeks is the time when Ways and Means has to look at things. So if we're going to get them there, this is when we have to send it over. So with that discussion, Representative Girard.
Mr. Chair, I have a little difficulty with the state telling the counties how to run their show money-wise. I don't think we've been good stewards ourselves. How are we going to teach somebody else?
I think part of it, what I think this is to do is to show where are those things where we share services and to get those balanced out maybe and to give recommendations back to the state on how to deal with those things. So I agree. That's why we're going to have county members as part of this group.
Thank you.
Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, a process question and then a comment, if you don't mind.
Sure.
We have no fiscal impact statement on this.
Thought we did.
We do. The proposal is to move it to Ways and Means.
Correct.
In my original notes on this bill, I wrote group's mission and expected output needs better definition, and I don't see that in the -1 amendments. I'm still unclear on this, what exactly the expected output is on this thing. I'm not sure that this is, I'm not really crazy about this thing.
Thank you very much. We'll see if Representative Nathanson is available so she can come and explain that, or if there's some other people in the crowd that have talked with her, but we'll go there. Any other discussion on this bill?
Question.
Yes.
Are you looking to adopt the -1s before we send it and then send it to Ways and Okay.
Yes. I was looking at adopting the -1s and then moving it to Ways and Means for further discussion. So
she doesn't need to come down from my side.
We're okay.
Yeah, I mean, I can just vote no.
That's true.
It's my privilege.
That's true.
She doesn't need to come down.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, you look for a motion.
Yes,
I move the -1s dated April, dated 3/20/09 into House Bill 2920.
Representative Edwards moves the -1 amendments to House Bill 2920. Any discussion on the amendments? Seeing none, anyone who disagrees with adding the amendments to House Bill 2920? Seeing none, so ordered. Let's
go ahead. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2920 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation with the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. Representative Edwards moves House Bill 2920 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that it go to Ways and Means by previous and it be sent to Ways and Means. I always mess that one up. Discussion. Yes, Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, In voting against this, it's more of my statement that I'm about had with task forces for this session and that I am not comfortable that the mission and output is defined enough for my satisfaction
in this particular bill. I mean, no offense to counties who have serious problems that need to be looked at, and maybe this task force is the answer and we'll get to solution, but I will be opposing the bill.
Okay. Representative Gelser.
Mr. Chair, picking up on Representative Berger's mention of the task forces, I too have been frustrated with the number of task forces that we put forward, but in our education committee today, we had a bill that would create a task force, and a member asked whether he had been dreaming that we had previously created this task force. And in fact, the task force had not been created because there was general agreement that people needed to get together in a room and come up with recommendations and bring them back to the legislature. But in the absence of such a task force bill, it did not happen. And therefore, we needed to establish the task force. So my 1 o'clock hearing today caused me to reconsider my general discomfort with task forces. I think there are some issues where we really do need to make sure that people are getting in a room, and I think around the loss of the timber payments and how we're going to cope with that, we need to keep people talking. So I'll support this and perhaps some other task force bills, despite my thoughts when I woke up this morning.
And I just want to speak to, having sat on a task force for all those many months during the last interim trying to work on the county payments, I think we came to a lot of fairly good understandings about where we were going, what we're doing. There are a bunch of recommendations, most of which we've moved to another biennium, some of which we've heard here and we'll keep working on. But the fact that the federal payments are going to end, and I believe they really will end, convinces me that we have to continue to have those people talking to each other so we understand how interdependent the counties, the cities, and the state are in solving this problem. And if we just wait for a while, we're going to be in trouble. So, Representative Girard.
Mr. Chair, a lot of counties, A, in the state, don't get this funding.
That's true.
B, each county's funding level is different. Lane County gets far more than Klamath. Jackson gets, so there is no statewide formula that can be determined for each county. I believe it's each county acting independently is the only way that they're going to solve their problems. And so I'll be joining Representative Berger in a no vote.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having served on some task force over the years, I view them with some mixed reaction. I served on one task force that met for 2 years and did nothing. I've served on another one that met for about 2 years and did some fairly significant work. But that's not the issue of concern or the statement that I would like to make here. It strikes me that this task force is in the better part of 20 years late. The fox has long ago been out of the hen house, and all of the chickens were taken with it. I have complained rather vociferously, I think at times in this body, about the lack of planning and preparation in the state of Oregon as far as its water policies are concerned, and have stolen one of your bills, Mr. Chair, to make another stab at so far a pretty difficult task for me. I certainly appreciate what my colleagues are saying, and I appreciate that there's not a lot of direction here, sometimes the task force needs to have very specific direction before it can I think function effectively. However, I am going to join in support of sending this to Ways and Means, hoping that it comes to the natural resource. Probably won't, but hoping it comes to natural resource so I can beat up on it some more. But, you know, I constantly am irritated with having problems and going out and burying our head in the sand and pretending like they're not problems. And, you know, I agree with you. I don't know when it is and when it will be, all of which probably depends solely upon how much muscle we can have in the United States Congress. But this is a dead pony. And, you know, we should have addressed this, and the counties should have addressed this long ago with some long-range planning for economic development. And I'm sorry, I mean, I look at some of these counties and I go through some of these towns and I see these little mill towns that I can fantasize, you know, or think. I'm old enough to remember back when they were cutting logs in the state. And I can see these little towns as absolutely thriving little communities with a very solid economic base and a real real culture, you know, in the communities. And you know, I see it at this point just kind of a dead community. I don't know that we'll get the answers from this particular task force, but unlike my colleagues who feel otherwise, I think I'm obligated to try.
Okay. Thank you. So, any other discussion? Seeing none, we'll have a roll call vote.
Representative Berard?
No.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Aye.
Representative Reese?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
No.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. Motion passes. Yes.
See how much my persuasive argument did for
it
you.
It did.
You got me to race right down here, Representative.
Representative Burks.
I hope that this conversation concentrates ways and means attention on actually getting some better definition of expected outcomes. And then I'll probably be yay man when they really get a lot done.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And credit for it.
No. Nathanson gets credit.
Okay, so we'll close our work session on House Bill 2920. And we'll open a work session on House Bill 2667. Work session, 2667. And we'll have a short explanation.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 2667 requires the Secretary of State to verify the residence of each candidate for state office. There is a -3 amendment which you have that requires the Secretary of State to verify the location of the residence of a candidate where the property indicated by address information is located less than 100 radial yards from a district boundary. Requires the Legislative Administration Committee to make available to the Secretary any mapping software and hardware used by the Legislative Assembly for redistricting to aid in address verification, and incorporates provisions of a previously proposed -1 amendment moving the effective date to cover elections held after November 2010.
Thank you.
And excuse me.
Yep.
We do have the fiscal statement that has been issued, and you should have a copy of that as well for the -3 and a no revenue with regard to the -3.
With that, I will take a motion for the -3s. Representative Edwards.
Mr. Chair, I move the -3s dated 4/30/09 into House Bill 2667.
Representative Edwards moves the -3 amendments to House Bill 2667 dated 4/30/09. Discussion on the amendments.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Yeah, just a question of clarification. I assume this means this applies only then to the offices of state representative and state senator.
Let's bring Rep. Mr. Pack forward, because I think it may also be the state. Yeah.
Committee, for the record, Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State. Representative Jensen, to your question, this applies to state offices, which include state representatives, state legislature, and also judges, county judges, circuit court judges, excuse me.
Okay. Further discussion of the amendments? Seeing none, is there any opposition to the amendments? Seeing none, so moved. I'll take a motion on the amended bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2667 to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Evers moves House Bill 2667 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Just want to say this is the bill that Representative Riley brought to us, and I want to say one more time on the record, I appreciate him doing that. I think that it will resolve some of the issues with regard to that, and I think it by clarifying that you only have to look at them when they're really on the edges, it does make it so that it's something that we can get done.
We have no ways and means to approve. This is not specific, but it does make it. It does.
Let me do a withdrawal of the motion.
Pardon? What's the fiscal side? We're just checking on the fiscal to make sure that we don't have... part of this is redistricting software that comes later on. This bill, I think, will not have because that's in the next election, so I think we're okay. Okay, so... Did you make a motion? We'll take a roll call vote. What? Did you move it?
Yeah.
Okay, do it.
Yeah. Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Excused.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Excused.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. Motion passes, and we will assign this to Representative Riley. And we'll close our work session on House Bill 2667. And we will open a work session. Oh, I'm going to move the work session on 2352. We have some amendments that we hadn't gotten discussed. We will move that to Wednesday. So we will move House Bill 2352 to Wednesday. And then we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 775. Short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Senate Bill 775 modifies election laws relating to ballot titles for certain property tax measures voted on in an election held in May or November. It conforms current statute to comply with a ballot measure repealing a portion of the double majority requirement passed by voters in 2008. In your previous discussions on this, you considered the double majority requirement and the need to conform the existing statute has a provision that requires the double majority of this, which would take care of that.
We don't have any amendments for this, right?
There are no amendments.
So I will entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 775 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Edwards moves Senate Bill 775 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Once again, we're going to trump the people of Oregon and their decision quite some time ago. While I may not disagree with this bill, I still have a problem with trumping a major vote in this state where the people have spoken. And then we attempt to change it.
Other discussions? I think From my belief, only my response to that one is that we asked the people again, did they want to? They rechanged it again, and now this kind of conforms everything. So from my perspective, this puts it back in the place, taking their second vote and putting it back into the order of things. But that's just my feeling about this bill as well. So with that, let's have a roll call vote.
Representative Berard?
No.
Representative Gelzer?
Excused.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Excused.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roland?
Aye. Motion passes, and we'll send that to the floor, and I will carry that bill. And we'll close our work session on Senate Bill 775, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2005. Short explanation, and then we'll have some invited testimony, so they can come on up together if they want. So,
thank you, Chair Roblin. House Bill 2005 requires the chief petitioners on prospective petitions for a state measure to file a statement declaring whether the persons will be paid for obtaining elector signatures. Has a number of additional requirements. This is, in general, a bill that covers reforms of the initiative process out of the Secretary of State's office. In previous meetings, you have discussed the highlights of the measure, the historical background on initiative legislation, public perceptions, and the need to restore confidence, among other issues. There are a series of amendments, and very briefly, they're all in your packet. Proposed -2 amendment would increase violation penalties to $10,000. The proposed -3 would allow the chief petitioner to designate a person to sign statements on behalf of the chief petitioner. The proposed -6 is a full rewrite of the original proposed measure. It eliminates early signature verification, narrows and defines the liability for instances where chief petitioners, contractors, and subcontractors should have known of a violation, places a 5-year time limit on the applicability of a prior criminal record as far as being a petition gatherer, adds provisions regarding a registered signature gatherers convicted of certain crimes, adds a severability clause. And proposed House Bill -7 amendments to the bill clarifies that volunteers are not subject to rolling turn-in requirements.
Thank you very much. So we'll start with the Secretary of State on their amendments, and they can go through. Yes, Representative.
Because these came in at the last minute, we do have no revenue impact statements on the record. This is different from the SMS that you've received. For all four of these amendments, there is no revenue impact. There is also minimal fiscal impact with regard to all four of the amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State. I'll be very brief and turn it over to Amy Wilson here on my right, who's been spearheading the work on this bill all session long. I just wanted to start off by first thanking the committee for the tremendous amount of attention you've been paying to this issue, but also to the folks who've been working with us on this bill, both in the advocates of reform and for members of the chief petitioner community, who have, in good faith, sat around the table and tried to work out as many of the issues as possible. At the end of the day, we may not always be in agreement all the time on all the issues, but I think as part of that process, we're ending up with a better and stronger bill. And I just would particularly like to thank Amy Wilson on our staff, who's done a tremendous job trying to steer this to a point before you today where we are hoping you can adopt some amendments and move the bill forward. And I'll be here to answer any other questions as you move along.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Amy Wilson. And I was just thinking that I would go through the amendments that we're putting forward in chronological order, if that makes sense.
That would be great.
Okay. So the first one is a -2 amendments. What this does is it's just real simple. It increases the maximum penalty to $10,000. And where this came from, there were a couple of representatives, Representative Nolan included in this. When we were going through and talking about the penalties, folks had said, you know, why don't we raise this? Right now, the maximum is $250, and we didn't feel like $250. And we wanted to bring it more in line with what we're already doing on other campaigns. I just want to clarify that this is something that the penalties will be established and for which penalties through a rules process and through a public hearing, so there will be ample time for folks who have concerns about what this looks like to come forward. I also want to point out that we have a handout that specifies some of the different ORSs that are relevant. And so these are not just any and all violations. These are pretty specific violations that include things like bribery and threats.
And that's the dash twos?
That's the dash twos.
Okay.
And do you want to take questions?
Pardon? Yeah.
Do you want to take questions per amendment, or do you want to...
Let's go through all your amendments first, and then we'll do some questions, and then we'll go to...
Mr. Chair?
Representative Gregg.
Which amendments are coming from the Secretary of State's office? Could you tell us?
The dash twos, the dash sixes, and the dash sevens.
Thank you.
Okay. So the dash sixes are the sort of overarching, it's sort of the rewrite of the bill. And I've given folks materials about what this does. Folks have a section-by-section analysis. And so I just thought I would spend this time explaining what we're doing differently and why we're doing it. After the first hearing we had here, we met with a slew of stakeholders and sort of hashed out some of the concerns folks have, and I think we are bringing forward an altogether better bill. The first is that we removed the early turn-in requirement, and we did that because we would have to dramatically change the statistical sampling process. And, you know, people have been really... It's a process that I think folks have a lot of confidence in, and it just seemed like it didn't make sense to move forward on that. We will still be able to address workload issues in that 85% of the workload is the pre-verification process, so that's opening the boxes up, sorting them, getting them in where they need to go. The other thing that we did was that we narrowed what is covered by what someone should have known. There were a couple of folks who'd raised some concerns, and the goal was to narrow should have known. What you have known, it has a larger... Let me think about how to say this. So should have known is a narrower list of offenses than what you have known. And so I intentionally sort of brought this forward because I think that there were lots of concerns about what this could possibly be. We added a five-year timeline to if you've been convicted of fraud, forgery, identity theft, just because we thought it didn't make sense that you weren't guilty forever and that we wanted to make that a five-year timeline. We added that you may not register if you've been convicted of fraud, forgery, identity theft. And what we wanted to do is we wanted to make sure that we caught people in the process when they were registering. So instead of them being out and gathering signatures, that we would prevent them from registering. So that would make it easier on them, and we wouldn't have to pull as many sheets. So we're trying to stop the problem before it happens. I know folks remember there was a lot of concern about potential harassment or things of that nature around the early turn-in. And so what we did is we added to sign or not to sign a petition on the undue influence statute. And so if you wanted to... We looked at this and we realized that the Secretary of State maybe didn't have the tools that we thought we should. And so this was the way that we wanted to sort of combat that. we changed the effective date. There were some concerns about changing the rules in the middle of the game, and so the best way we thought we could handle that is we would just start January 1, would apply for prospective petitions and initiative petitions. It gives ample time to get prepared for the rolling turn-in requirements. And lastly, we added a severability clause. So that's the dash sixes. And the dash sevens, advocates, Dan Meek in particular, had brought up that we never had the intent of rolling turn-in to apply to volunteers. It was not clear that it did not apply, and so we asked for a dash seven amendment to clarify that volunteers are not going to be held to the rolling turn-in requirements. And that is all of our, those are all of the details of our amendments, and we'd be happy to take questions.
So any yes, Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 13, could you explain why you came to that conclusion? In other words, I have a little problem with you throwing out all the signatures because they might have been obtained by someone who was guilty of a crime within 5 years. Mm-hmm. Why does that negate all the people who signed the petition that were valid?
Mm-hmm. I think that's something that is really a core to this bill, and we sort of have went through the discussions about are we treating voters in the right way. And the concern that we have is that as long as you can still gather signatures through fraudulent means and get access to the ballot, there's nothing that's going to stop people from doing it. And so we think once we make it to where if you are going to gather signatures illegally and they're going to get thrown out, you really don't have an incentive to do that.
Follow up,
yes.
We have a problem with public perception on disenfranchising voters on these type of petitions. This is going to really, I think, continue that feeling on the general public that even if they're qualified to sign, how do they know whether the petitioner has a felony record or whatever?
Representative, this is one of the reasons that we, the Secretary of State, is going to do the background checks, and we're going to be able to catch folks before they register as signature gatherers. So the idea is to catch people before this happens. We also have a perception of our initiative process being riddled with fraud and forgery, and so we're really trying to address that head-on without disenfranchising voters.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Could have the petitioner carry a gun and point the gun at the petitioner. That would pretty well signal that there's a real problem. Thank you very much for your response.
You. Other questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you. So I understand the dash twos are separate from the six and seven. And if the Secretary of State were really happy, we'd adopt the twos, the sixes, and the sevens?
That's correct.
Okay. A question on the dash
yes.
twos, please. Let's go back to that $10,000 fine. What's the purpose and what are we getting at there? I don't have ORS 260.55, 558, and 575, and 517 right here in my brain. So would you explain what those... Is it there somewhere in these?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that is where?
So you have a list that has chief petitioners and contractors and subcontractors. It's a list of numbers. A standalone piece of paper in your material that I handed out.
But I don't think I have it. Oh, it came with that. Okay. So explain the $10,000. Why the $10,000?
So we did the $10,000 because we wanted to be consistent. Already, that's the maximum penalty that we're already doing in other instances and in other campaigns. And so the specific ORSs that we refer to is bribery. These are the maximum penalties. So it would be a $10,000 maximum for bribery or the sale of signatures, threats and intimidation, false oath on required forms, false signatures, false statements, and unqualified signers. And then it would also apply to Measure 26, the ban on paper signatures. So we specified what we thought were sort of the more egregious offenses out there.
And Chair Roblin, Representative Berger, I think, you know, you look at penalties as a deterrent to bad behavior, and these current provisions, these current statutes, we think are actually rather egregious violations, carried a maximum penalty of $250. And so for some folks, the calculation could be it's cheaper to pay the penalty and do the illegal behavior than anything else. And so what Amy's referencing is maximum penalties for other election law violations that have a maximum of $10,000. That won't mean that every violation that occurs will get a $10,000 penalty. It just sets the cap and will, by rule, determine a matrix for penalties of the violations within that range.
Thank you.
Further questions of those two right now? Hearing none, we'll move on to Mr. Day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for your record, Ross Day, Executive Director of Common Sense for Oregon. I'm also a partner in a firm called Voice of the Electorate, LLC, which is a signature petition circulating firm. We just started in March this year. First, I want to speak to the Dash 3 amendments. Those are my amendments that for your consideration. And to best of my knowledge, there's no opposition to the amendments. What they do is, before a signature gatherer is allowed to go out and circulate a petition, the chief petitioners, all three of them, have to sign what's called the SEL 309 form. And it gets to be very cumbersome. You start faxing back and forth and so on and so forth just to get somebody okay to start circulating a petition. What the Dash 3 amendments say is that a chief petitioner can designate a person, presumably, you know, either another chief petitioner or whomever, to go ahead and sign the only the SEL 309 forms, no other forms. On behalf of the chief petitioners. It just facilitates the process, saves a lot of paper, I hope, and I think makes it a more streamlined process. And that's really all that the Dash 3s do. So if you have any questions.
Any questions on the Dash 3s? Okay.
And then on the Dash 6s and Dash 7s, I'm a little torn because I want to support them, but I have a hard time with it for a number of reasons. First, just something that Representative Garrard brought up about Section 13 that says if I've been convicted or assessed a penalty under these, I can't circulate a petition. Well, this applies to me whether I'm doing it for pay or as a volunteer. So I can't go out as a volunteer under that particular section of the bill and circulate. I think that's got grave constitutional concerns. But there's my biggest concern. I've got two very large concerns with this. The first is the should have had knowledge standard. And the second is the early turn-ins. First, I'll take the latter first, early turn-ins. We were told that the reason for the early turn-ins before was to start the verification process. Now that's been taken out, and I understand why. That's a logical reason why. What's the purpose? There's no other purpose to turn those in other than what's going to happen, as Mr. Meek says in his letters, what they call data mining. People who oppose certain ballot measures will go into the Secretary of State's office, their public records, they'll get them, they'll find out who signed, who the most productive signature gatherers are, and then go out and start harassing those folks, calling people saying, did you really sign this measure? Did you really sign this measure? Do you realize that this is going to kill little kids? Did you really want to sign that measure? And somebody say no, and then they start screaming fraud, forgery, you know, so on and so forth. That's a genuine concern of mine. On the flip side, as the owner of a petition circulation company, the fact that I get to get those things out of my possession as quickly as possible certainly has its upside as well. I think if we're going to have early turn-ins, I think you really ought to consider not making them, and I hate saying this because I'm very pro-public record, but making those things private until such time as you submitted enough signatures that you think you've qualified the measure for the ballot. So if I turn in every month and eventually, say, February of an even-numbered year, I've turned in 100,000 signatures, then go ahead and make them public. But until that time, I mean, I think this opens this up for undue influence, frankly, and fraud and forgery coming from the other side. I think that's a genuine concern. I spoke to the chair about this quite a bit, and I don't want my folks out there who are trying to do a good job, who are trying to follow the law, to be harassed because they're doing a good job at their profession. My biggest concern, though, is the should-have-had-knowledge concern language. Right now, there's an administrative rule that says chief petitioners are responsible for ensuring compliance with Article 4, Section 1B of the Oregon Constitution, which is Measure 26. Question is, what is ensure compliance? Well, in the real world, if I were to write into a contract with my painting contractor, you shall follow the laws regarding compensation of your employees, meaning you'll employ them at least the minimum wage. If I were to be sued if it turns out the contractor's not paying his employees minimum wage at least, that employee doesn't get to go after me and sue me. I'm not held liable by the Bureau of Labor and Industries for that guy not getting paid his minimum wage. And so, generally speaking, I'm not aware of anything other any circumstance where a contractual provision doesn't satisfy the ensuring compliance with the law standard. Myself and Dave Honeycutt right now are the subject of an action by the Secretary of State's office where we're both being fined $250. The case is at the Oregon Court of Appeals. We had a contractual provision where we said you cannot violate the law. We also checked in with our contractor, Tim Trickey, every week. Facts in the record make this clear. Every week to make sure that he was following the law, and that his subcontractors were following the law. In fact, there was a letter from Mr. Lindback of the Elections Division Director that said you should check in with your contractors on a periodic basis to make sure they are complying with the law. Facts in this record, they established that clearly. Any reasonable person would hold that what you're doing in those instances, what we did, would more than meet the standard of ensuring compliance. I think any one of you sitting here would have done the same thing that we did. Well, we're still fine because they said we didn't ensure compliance with the law. If that's not ensuring compliance with the law, I don't know what is. So what is should have had knowledge? What does that mean? Now, in fairness to the Secretary of State's office and Ms. Wilson in particular, I understand what they mean. What they mean is, are you putting your head in the sand? Are you completely ignoring what's going on? But in our case, we had hundreds of people circulating our petition, three of whom, allegedly out of all of these hundreds of people circulating our petition, we chose to just, Tim Trickey chose to pay just those three by the signature. And because those three allegedly were paid by the signature, somehow we hadn't satisfied that standard. The should have had knowledge standard. There's two standards. There's a tort standard that says, would a reasonable person have known that something had happened? But the Secretary of State's office, and this only from the Attorney General's office, argue that this is actually more of a vicarious liability under the theory of respondeat superior, which is a strict liability, which means if this happened, you're liable no matter what, even if you didn't know. Even if you didn't know. And they're trying to meld the two into one, and you just can't do that. What you're telling me is, if somebody violates the law, I should have known that. I think what we're really getting at here is, look, what a reasonable person would have taken to make sure that the law was being followed? And I think I've submitted a letter to everyone with some proposed language that would actually help define what I think we mean by should have had knowledge. And I think this is an important issue. When you're touching on First Amendment concerns, this is an important issue that I don't think you should just punt and let the Senate take over. I think this is something that, the committee ought to consider. There are a lot of good things in this bill that I really like. The undue influence amendments are fantastic. I think that's a great idea. The background checks that's just good government. That's gonna speed up the process considerably for everybody, and I think will actually result in better background checks as a whole. But on the whole, this bill still, I mean, the amendments, the Dash 6 and the Dash 7s, I still have a lot of concerns about. And I'd ask you to tread lightly and consider at least defining what should have had knowledge means before you send this bill to the floor. But with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions? I have a couple, and I'll probably address them back to Amy. The Section 13 volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
So if I have committed those violations, am I unable to circulate petitions as a volunteer?
No, what happens is that volunteers, paid signature gatherers need to come to the Secretary of State's office and they go through a registration process. Volunteers are not likely, they're not going to go through that process. They don't have to register for the Secretary of State, so there would be nothing that would prohibit them from gathering signatures.
Well, respectfully, Mr. Chair,
yep.
It says the Secretary of State may not include an account under 245, 250, and so on and so forth for purposes of determining whether an initiative, referendum, or recall petition prospective petition for a state measure to be initiated contains the required number of signatures of electors. Any signatures obtained by a person, doesn't say a person paid, who the secretary determines during the 5-year period prior to the date the signatures were obtained, violated those laws. So that doesn't say a person being paid to circulate petitions. So.
Okay.
So a couple of things. The Dash 7s, just to want to clarify this, they speak to this whole volunteer issue. But this is the part where, you know, this is a complaint-driven process. It is, you know, possible that if there were to be a complaint lodged against someone who was a signature gatherer, I think that's a different issue.
No, this says that if you're a volunteer, for instance, me, right now I'm being subject to a fine, potentially $250 fine for allegedly paying people by the signature. What this says is even if I went out as a volunteer and circulated these petitions, circulated a measure of mine, as a volunteer, on my own time, they can't count my signatures. That's what that says.
And just to clarify, were you already a registered?
No, this doesn't say anything about being registered. All this says is if you were convicted or found to have violated a statute, here's what we're not going to count your signatures, whether you're a paid signature gatherer or a volunteer signature gatherer. That's how I read that.
You don't read it as if someone came and complained to me. That or complain to the Secretary of State's office that this particular person, I am not sure, let's say I was concerned that they may have stolen some of my identity or records kinds of issues, and so I make a complaint. That might lead to an investigation which could show that the person did have a previous conviction, and then all of them could be done, even if they were a volunteer.
Well,
that's different than how you're reading it is if, I don't know how they would find out if it's a volunteer.
Well, because you're going to, on every petition sheet, you're going to sign, put your name, you're going to certify it, right? If you're a volunteer, it's on a white sheet. If you're not a volunteer, if you're being paid, you're going to, okay. And this doesn't say if a complaint is filed.
Gotcha.
It says the Secretary of State may not include an account. And then it goes on to say any person who the Secretary of State determines during the 5-year period prior to the date signatures were obtained have been convicted of a criminal offense involving basically veracity and then has a civil penalty imposed under 260.995, which is what we're being cited with, for a violation of 250.048 or 260.062, which are the statutes relating to pay by the signature. And we're not actually being penalized under those two statutes because they didn't exist at the time, but we're being penalized under administrative rule. But it still remains the same. If I'm a volunteer, if I'm out on my own and I'm circulating petitions, under that section it says the secretary may not count my signature, the signatures I collect.
Another question, should have known. In the previous deal, the one you were under, it was ensure that, right? And then
ensure compliance.
Compliance. Yes. So we have two different standards, but you believe that they are being interpreted the same?
No.
Okay.
No. My point bringing this up is how is somebody supposed to know when they should have had knowledge? Now, in my conversations with Ms. Wilson, I don't want to put words in her mouth. I understand what she's saying. It's basically the reasonable person standard. Would a reasonable person know, you know, a reasonable person take reasonable steps to make sure that a violation wasn't occurring? That's how I understand what a should have had knowledge means, to the best of my knowledge.
Okay.
Wait, I said that wrong.
So I guess what I would say then is if I understand the facts as you presented them in your previous one, if I went down and checked all the times, I would have expected that under a reason, should have known, to mm-hmm. maybe have met that standard.
That's right.
I'm not sure that it would have met the standard under ensure that compliance. Yes, Amy?
I think we interpret this differently. Because I think that this is a reasonable maybe we agree that this is a reasonable standard that shows up all over in Oregon law. But what I heard you say was didn't know versus should have known, and I think that that's I think that's different because this is we're talking about what we can expect from somebody as an employer and as a chief petitioner.
Correct.
This is what they should have known, not oh I didn't know that. It's we are holding you to a standard
right.
for these types of things.
The question, though, is, I apologize for interrupting, the question is what's the standard? The standard is reasonable person, reasonable inquiry. That's just what I want to make. I
agree. I think, and Amy's shaking her head, that she's saying that is the standard under which should have known is applied.
Should have had knowledge.
Should have had knowledge.
Right, and I would argue that just to clarify, you're going to, the burden of proof for what if somebody should have known and proving that somebody should have known that they had reasonable access to this information, I think is not that easy.
As long as the chair agrees that should have had knowledge is a reasonable person standard, then I'm good with
kind
that.
Kind of where I thought I was at. Yes.
And if maybe the SMS reflected that as well, okay. That would be fantastic.
Okay. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Amy, or anybody from the Secretary of State's office, what's the process for enforcement of this particular piece of the bill, the should have had knowledge aspect? Who makes that determination? Is it somebody that collects the information, a staff person, or does it go up a level?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, in all of this, it's a complaint-driven process. So it would be a member of the public who believed that there was that a chief petitioner should have had knowledge of a violation would file a complaint with the Elections Division. Our staff would open an investigation. These investigations are already set in statute, so it's not a new process that we're creating. It's just new instances. The staff would investigate the situation, come up with a decision as to whether or not there had been a violation. That order is signed then by the elections director, and it's available for appeal.
Great. Follow-up.
Mr. Day might want to...
Somebody who's the subject of a complaint is given the opportunity to present evidence and that kind of stuff. So it's not like they just decide from on high and you're doomed. So you are given the opportunity to defend yourself.
Okay. And my follow-up is, to defend yourself to whom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, to the Elections Division.
To whom in the Elections Division?
Hearings officer.
Hearings officer. Okay. So not...
Oh,
floor staff.
No, the ultimate decision comes from the director of the Elections Division and then can be appealed through a contested case hearing.
Okay, thank you.
Right? And then you go to court of appeals. Yeah.
Okay, further questions of this witness or witnesses? Okay. We may call you back in a second because I also have Dan Meek that I have invited to come and speak as well. And I appreciate the emails, Dan, since last Friday. So,
thank you for the opportunity today, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dan Meek. I have represented many groups who have attempted to put measures on the ballot, myself on a volunteer, unpaid basis. I have submitted written testimony for the session today that raises four issues, and I think that the amendments being offered to you are very significantly destructive of the initiative process. The first one is the massive increase in penalties, increasing the penalty for the violations by a factor of 40. And you were told that this just applies to violations sort of like bribery, but it doesn't. The example provided in my testimony is an alleged false statement by a circulator about the measure. That is one of the statutes that is specified in the amendments as having a $10,000 per incident fine. That is ORS 260.555, which says no person attempting to obtain signatures on or causing to be circulated an initiative, referendum, or recall petition shall knowingly make any false statement regarding the contents, meaning, or effect of the petition to any person who signs it, attempts to sign it, is requested to sign it, or requests information concerning it. Now, back in 2006, when we had our campaign finance reform measures on the ballot, complaints were filed against our circulators for making false statements. And I give an example. One of the kinds of false statements is, well, our measure bans all contributions by corporations to political candidates. Well, technically it doesn't. Technically it allows each corporation to make a $500 contribution to a separate segregated political action committee for the purpose of obtaining contributions from individuals associated with the corporation. So it's very easy for a circulator to make a false statement about a measure. What this says is that if there's a false statement made about a measure, then not only is the circulator responsible, but the chief petitioner is responsible. It's $10,000 a hit. My concern about this is not that people are going to be penalized a lot of $10,000 hits. My concern about it is the intimidation value, especially when it's combined with the should-have-known standard. And by the way, the should-have-known standard is not a reasonable person standard unless you put that in this bill. And if you don't put it in this bill, then it's not the law, and the Oregon courts are directed by the Oregon Supreme Court not to add things into law that aren't there. And it's not ambiguous, should have known. It is a standard. Unless you say a reasonable person should have known, then it will be interpreted as should have known and without the reasonable person standard. But in any event, we have a circulator goes out and makes some false statements. Doesn't matter if they are material false statements. They can be made to someone who is there specifically for the purpose of taping the circulator and trying to entrap the circulator into making false statements, asking leading questions. We've had experience with that, too. And now you're going to place this liability on all the chief petitioners. And I would simply ask this. If you were a civic-minded citizen and you're asked to be a chief petitioner on a statewide measure, and you can be subjected to multiple $10,000 fines for conduct by circulators that you actually have no knowledge of, that you have no ability to prevent, are you going to be a chief petitioner on the measure? And if you don't know about all this liability before you become a chief petitioner, if someone comes to you and explains to you this enormous liability that is now placed upon you, what are you going to do? Under law, a statewide petition can only have three chief petitioners. The Secretary of State takes the position that if any of the three chief petitioners withdraw from the petition at any time before it's certified as a measure, which is 90 days before the election, then the entire proposed measure, the entire petition and initiative is dead, even if all of the signatures have already been collected, and even all of the signatures have already been verified and there are sufficient signatures. It's dead if one of them withdraws. And I see this as being an enormous tool for opponents of the initiative process to deprive the voters of Oregon from voting on measures that they should be able to vote on. By the way, I recently read an article in my favorite bedtime reading, Election Law Journal, from 2009, by a professor who did regression analysis of what causes people to think government is corrupt and what causes them not to think so. And she states, overall, the results suggest that it is difficult to use political reform measures to decrease perceptions of corruption. The exception is the initiative process. Perceptions of corruption are lower in states with an initiative process, especially where the process is used regularly. States might take action to increase the number of measures on the ballot. For example, states could lower the number of signatures required to place a question on the ballot. Such a step would make it easier to bring questions directly to voters. This study suggests that giving more lawmaking power to the public helps reduce their perceptions of government corruption. Now what you're doing is you're placing chief petitioners in a position of being intimidated so that the measures that they've put in so much work on and can be removed from the ballot if one of the chief petitioners bows to intimidation. Also on the should have known liability standard, that also applies to these kinds of violations. That is, a circulator allegedly makes a false statement. It's not just pertaining to bribery type of violations. My second major concern is the monthly turn-ins. We're now told that the monthly turn-ins will not be used to do verification of the signatures, which I thought was the main rationale for doing it in the first place. I see no reason to do it, and I certainly see no reason to make those public records. Where people, and this is not a hypothetical concern, this has been done in past years, where folks have submitted their signatures early under the voluntary early turn-in statute, opponents have taken those signature sheets and begun calling the people, match them up with phone numbers, and begin calling people who signed. Say, do you remember signing this? And as we've mentioned before, some small number of persons will not remember signing the petition, even if they did. A small number of persons would not remember voting for the chair in his district, even though they did. And then come the charges of fraud, forgery, etc. Complaints to the Secretary of State. Our experience is that complaints of election law violations involving initiatives of the Secretary of State take on average 2.5 years to resolve. So during the entire campaign, the opponents point their finger and say, you, chief petitioners, you are under state investigation for violation of law in this campaign. It doesn't matter how baseless it is. And I wish there were time. I would give you examples of the kind of baseless complaints we face, but nevertheless we're then tarred with the epithet under state investigation for violation of law for the remainder of the campaign. This would greatly facilitate that. My third point was that House Bill 2005 in general extends the incredibly detailed regulatory scheme for initiative petitions into the prospective petitioning process. That's where you just go out and collect 1,000 signatures. So now in order to collect just 1,000 signatures just to start the ballot title process under this bill, if you're using any paid circulators, you have to go through the entire registration process, you have to submit voluminous records every month, and all of that. There was one provision in HB 2082 that was a good provision, I thought, and that was the one signature sheet template that anyone could download from the internet, sign it once, not have to sign it twice as both the signer and the circulator, which is extremely confusing, and mail it in. Yet, House Bill 2005 extends all the other requirements of initiative petitions into the prospective petition process, but not this one. So I think it's unbalanced for that reason. Finally, I pointed out when I obtained the -6 amendments on last Friday, I pointed out it would destroy that is requiring, basically saying any signature more than 30 days old if it's turned in is invalid, would destroy the opportunity for volunteers to collect signatures because they simply don't turn them in every 30 days. I thank the Secretary of State for changing that. And I would like to perhaps clear up a misconception. In the testimony today, I heard a couple of times about meetings with stakeholders. The Secretary of State's office met with a slew of stakeholders, etc. I wasn't invited to any of these meetings. So I don't want you to have the impression that anything of these, either the bill or the amendments, was the result of any sort of negotiation or discussion with me. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Meek? I guess the only thing I would say is I do appreciate your diligence, and hopefully we've done better at getting them up on the web faster, and we've been getting them to people before we actually had the meetings. And I do appreciate that. And whether you were at the meetings, I will say that you did have some impacts, because when you send in information that many of us talk and represent some of those ideas. So I do appreciate your continuing to make sure that your ideas are put forward. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Chair.
Thanks. We also had a Dash 5 amendment that we aren't going to hear, and the person who brought it forward mentioned that I would just mention that we did receive it. It had to do with perfecting signatures. If people had claimed that the signature was invalid and they could claim it, I've had a number of discussions about that. We had some testimony earlier that when that happens, they had an expert look at signatures, and they said their concern was there were more that were agreed to that should have gone out than the ones the other way. So the issue there, that's not one of the ones that I'm really considering right now, because I think if you're going to do one side, you have to do both sides, and then the process gets very, very expensive. So with that, I think we'll introduce some of these amendments and at least get those put together, and then we may vote on the bill. This is a work session, and the other thing I guess I would open up, if there's anybody who would like to be invited to say something, because we are in a work session as opposed to a public hearing, if you would raise your hand, I would invite you, because I just want to make sure that we have this as open as it can possibly be. I have appreciated all of the comments from people, and there's been a lot of people who have sent comments in over the last few weeks with regard to each and every part of this. And for the record, well, let's go through the amendments first. So, Representative Edwards.
Mr. Chair, are you looking for motions on the Dash 2s and then the Dash 6s and Dash 7s? Am I...
I would also put in the dash,
and the dash
threes.
And the dash threes.
Yep.
Okay. And do we need to do those one at a time?
I think we do need to do them one at a time.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments dated 4-14-09 to House Bill 2005.
Representative Edwards moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 2005. Any discussion? I guess on this one, I would like to point out that this is a rulemaking process. This is the maximum fine. I would encourage the Secretary of State to make sure that there is a hierarchy in this and that it starts out much smaller and works up if there's a whole multiple violations. I've heard that testimony, so that's for the record. Any other comments about the Dash 2s? Is there any objection to the Dash 2s? Seeing none, so moved. Representative Edwards.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3s dated 4-24-09 to House Bill 2005.
Representative Edwards moves the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2005. Any discussion on those? I, again, appreciate people bringing forward the different ideas to make sure we get this better. So I appreciate the Dash 3s and allowing for the opportunity for the chief petitioners to have another person accept those signatures. Is there any other discussion? Seeing none, are there anybody opposed to the Dash 3 amendments? Seeing none, they pass. Representative Edwards.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 6 amendments dated 4-29-09 into House Bill 2005.
Representative Edwards moves the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 2005. Again, any discussion? On this one, I want to make a couple comments from the floor. One, I do, I want to put on the record that from my perspective, when it says should have known, that means the reasonable person standard for should have known. If they want to put that in actually in the bill later, the Senate can talk about that. But that, to me, that was the testimony here, and that was the standard that was being set by the Secretary of State's office. It's also the one that we've all heard from, and so I just want to clearly state that that is the should-have-known standard that we're looking at here.
And Mr. Chair,
yes.
I'd like to say that if I hear of harassment of petition signers, I mean, nothing to me would be more offensive an outcome of this bill passing than harassment by petition opponents of petition signers. And I really hope that that doesn't happen. And that's, and I, well,
thank you.
I don't have anything else to say about it.
On that one, I would say, I would add that
there'll be a bill next session.
I would add that I have a real difficult time taking things out of public law, the public information. But this is a case that if I saw that kind of stuff happening, I would be the first to put the bill in that says we're going to exempt these from the public records law. Because that one makes me nervous too, and I will be watching closely as well. Representative Girard.
Just a comment on the dash sixes. Excuse me. I will vote for the dash sixes, but I do want to be on record as saying I still have trouble with eliminating valid signatures simply because the collector was not properly cleared beforehand.
Thank you on that. And I guess that my issue there, too, is that clearly we need to make sure that people get out the information and that we do all the record checks and so on, because I agree, best prevention is doing it ahead of time. And I will, my understanding of the bill, and I'm going to have to look at the wording in the final analysis, and I'll talk to the Senate about this one as well, has to do with the volunteers, and we will continue to work on that one. Yes, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While I am not a advocate of the initiative system, and quite frankly, I find it to be the antithesis of representative democracy, contrary to some of the testimony that we have heard in this room at various times, I will, you know, be... I will support the passage of this bill here with the understanding that we will tighten up with the language you have suggested, or perhaps other language that would be satisfactory that the agency would come forth with having to do with the issue of should have known. I do find that in itself a little vague and ambiguous, and I appreciate your comments and statements on it. I'd just like to have on the record that I encourage that, and I would encourage the agency to work with the Senate to come up to a better solution to that, that it's tightened up where there may not be some uncertainty or there may be confusion on it at some point down the line when perhaps none of us are going to be in this chamber to, with maybe the exception of the young Mr. Edwards or Mr. Reed.
Thank you. Any further discussion on the dash sixes? Is there any objection to the dash sixes? Seeing none, they are now part of the bill. Representative Edwards.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash sevens dated 5409 into House Bill 2005.
Representative Edwards moves the dash seven amendments to House Bill 2005. Discussion. Again, this one I do want to compliment because it happened fairly quickly. I want to compliment the Secretary of State's office in acknowledging that volunteers are different. This bill was not really built to deal with the volunteers, and to clearly make sure that we understand that they are not covered by some of the same is an important part of the bill. So I thank people for the input there as well. Any other discussion on the dash sevens? Seeing none, any opposition to the dash sevens? Seeing none, so ordered. We might as well take a motion to the bill.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2005 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Edwards moves the House Bill 2005 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Excused.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Excused.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Excused.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. Motion passes, and I will carry this bill as well. Okay, we've got some more time, so...
Would you like to take...
the amendment.
What's the next one?
25.
Okay. We're going to close the work session on 2005, and we're going to open a work session on 2511. Short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, House Bill 2511 directs the Secretary of State by rule to adopt an electronic voting system to allow long-term absent electors to cast ballots electronically, allows the Secretary of State to utilize U.S. Department of Defense voting assistance system for electronic transmission of election materials, requires the Secretary of State to adopt rules governing procedures for receiving ballots cast electronically. There is an amendment to this bill. House Bill 2511-1 provides a new Section 2 that allows ballots to be cast using a facsimile machine, establishes procedures for casting ballots by facsimile, and sets the procedures for verifying electors' signatures transmitted by facsimile, deletes the original provision of House Bill 2511 in Section 2 requiring the Secretary of State to adopt by rule an electronic voting system using the Internet. Proponents assert that the amendment addresses concerns raised about security and verifiability of electronic voting. The Dash 2 amendment, which you have before you, adds a provision amending ORS 246021 by adding the phrase, except as provided in Section 2 of this Act. The intent of that amendment is to eliminate the conflict in HB 2511. It would expressly allow long-term absent electors to be filed by facsimile, and ORS 246021 prohibits filing ballots by facsimile. The Dash 2 amendment incorporates the provisions of the Dash 1, so you would be voting only on the Dash 2 if you chose to enact that.
This is the bill that came from Representative Wisnett that started out much larger, asking us to vote over the Internet for people outside the country. We weren't sure about the safety of that, and so we have amended it to the point it is now. And I'll invite Mr. Pack up just to make sure that we feel comfortable with the ability for us to clearly have the rules set out that we can use the facsimile to do some voting and at least start the process of giving people an option if they're outside the country. Mr. Pack.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State. The Dash 2 amendments, you've heard testimony on the vast majority of the Dash 2 amendments as they were incorporated in the Dash 1. The only change between the two amendments since you last heard this bill is on page 3, section 3, which, as the administrator mentioned, exempts facsimiles for military and overseas voters from another statute that prohibits the use of facsimile for voting. So we wanted to clarify to make sure that, yes, notwithstanding some other statutory provisions, this is allowed. As to the security issue, I think that, as you've heard on other security issues in this committee, we can't go into all the details per se, but I have had a number of conversations with our election staff and with some of the county clerks as to how this would work. Representative Edwards asked a question in the prior hearing about ballots being public record and whether or not folks would be able to go in and see how the military or overseas folks were voting. And we believe that we'll have a way of protecting that information up until the date when the election results are certified, and then we'll be able to separate the identity of the voter from the ballot itself when ballots become available for public inspection under current public records law.
I will entertain then, unless there's any other questions, a motion on the Dash 2s.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2s dated 4-15-09 into House Bill 2511.
Representative Edwards moves the Dash 2 amendments dated 4-15-09 into House Bill 2511. Any discussion on the amendments? Seeing none. Any objection to the amendments? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Edwards.
You do not need the dash ones, right?
Does not need the dash
ones. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2511 as amended to the floor with due pass recommendation.
And?
With a subsequent referral, Ways and Means.
Representative Edwards moves House Bill 2511 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Any discussion? Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With a certain amount of disappointment on my part for this bill, I quite frankly think that at least in terms of the military or other personnel that are overseas, I would have liked to have tried at least an experiment, with the electronic voting process for these people. I think it would have been an excellent idea. I think the chances of, some distortion of the outcome of elections from these folks overseas would be somewhere close to zero. And I quite frankly think this technology is quite capable of providing as much security as any of the other systems that we have had, which our history is fraught with illustrations of people voting the last 238 or whichever it was out of one precinct in South Texas, all who voted in alphabetical order, which is a remarkable achievement. I have to express some, a little concern. I would like to have seen the technology be given a chance on an issue of this type.
Thank you. And I too would love to get to that point. I understand the concerns right now, and I think our step this session with the voter registration online is a good step. We'll continue to work on getting our equipment up, but I understand that concern as well. So, other discussion on this bill? We'll have a roll call vote.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Gelzer?
Excused.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Excused.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Excused.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roland?
Aye. Motion passes, and it'll be on its way to Ways and Means. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 323. We'll have a short... First, did I close... Let me make sure I closed the work session on House Bill 2511 as well. So, short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 323 allows persons required to submit written reports to the Legislative Assembly to do so through posting an electronic form of the report on the Internet and providing online location and an executive summary. Required the distribution of the physical copy of the executive summary to each legislator, the offices of the presiding officers, and legislative administrator. Declares an emergency, and it's effective on passage. There is a dash one amendment before you dealing with some concerns that were raised about the need for hard copies of the bill. The dash one amendment deletes the requirement to provide a copy of the report to the offices of the Speaker of the House, President of the Senate, and Legislative Administration Committee, replaces that requirement with a requirement to provide one copy of the report to the Legislative Administrator.
So this is a bill that I think is starting to get us away from the paper a little bit more and more to using the Internet, which I think we're all needing to get to. Entertain a motion.
If you hold on just a moment, Mr. Chair, while I shuffle through my paper at my desk and search for the amendments that we're looking for here. I move the dash ones into dated 4/20/09 into Senate Bill 323.
Representative Edwards moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 323, dated 4/20/09. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Any opposition? Seeing none. So ordered. Representative Edwards.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 323 to the floor with a
as amended,
with due pass recommendation.
Representative Edwards moves Senate Bill 323 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to support the bill. And just for another motivation, I think it will make myself significantly more popular with my staff. We'll have less of these reports to deal with.
That's another good reason to consider it. Other discussions? Seeing none, we'll do a roll call vote.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Excused.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Excused.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Excused.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. Motion passes. And we're going to close our work session on Senate Bill 323.
You got a carrier.
Did this one go to waste? It didn't. Would you like to carry?
Yeah.
And we'll have Representative Edwards carry.
We did not make a determination if we carried carry by the senator.
It went away. That's right.
Okay, with that, I don't see Representative Galizzi or anyone here for
3042. Were they going
to
come?
They were supposed to come. Understood they would. You want us to call them and take care of 3042?
Yeah, we can do that. So we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 330A. And as we had our public hearing a little earlier on 338, this is the bill that Senator Walker came and talked to us about. It is a bill regarding a little bit more transparency and printing in the voter's pamphlet the procedures under which you can
Just an explanation of the procedures that you could do to file a complaint.
To file a complaint, that's where I went blank. So I would entertain, there's no amendments to that.
No amendments. Oh,
I'll.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 330 to the floor, 330A to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Edwards moves Senate Bill 330A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, we'll have a roll call vote.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Excused.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Excused.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Excused.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. Motion passes. And is there anybody here that would love to carry? Representative Girard will carry. So we'll close our work session on Senate Bill 330A. And let's take a short recess while we wait for a couple people to come if we're going to hear about our bill. So we'll take a short recess. Motion. We don't have a quorum, so we're going to move the hearing on House Bill 3482 to Wednesday. I do want to acknowledge to you that we had a bill that came last week, and we passed it. We had a note that was supposed to go to Ways and Means, but that was incorrect. So we sent it to Ways and Means when we shouldn't have sent it to Ways and Means. That happened to be the bill with regard to the telecommunications in Eastern Oregon. Should have gone directly to the floor. It will be back as soon as we can post it, and we'll send it to the floor so we do the right thing. So it should be on its way by Friday. So
actually, Mr. Chair, that probably should have a revenue statement.
Yeah, it should have a positive revenue statement.
There's a $5 million check with that.
I was a little concerned when we thought it had one because I couldn't understand where that was, but it has been corrected. It'll come back to us, and we will send it on its way. So I appreciate all of your work. I thank you all for all of your work today, and with that, we are going to adjourn. Did I open a... No, I didn't. We're going to adjourn the Rules Committee for today, and I thank you for your attendance. And I guess I would say one more thing is that I thank both